I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio in San Antonio, and this is Fronteras, a program about issues along the U.S.-Mexico border and changing demographics in the Southwest. If you drive or walk by what was once the heart of Dallas's Little Mexico, you wouldn't know it was also near the site of a tragedy. 45 years ago, a Dallas police officer shot and killed a 12-year-old Mexican-American boy while he sat handcuffed inside a police car. As KERA's Stella Chavez reports, a public art project and new documentary are remembering Santos Rodriguez and the impact of his death.
Dallas Park Board member Jesse Moreno wasn't born yet when Santos Rodriguez was shot. But growing up, the 33-year-old heard the story many times.
When I see images of Santos, I see myself. I see every Latino young boy who is growing up through Dallas who, he is basically looking in the mirror of a young adolescent here in Dallas.
It was 2 a.m. on July 24th, 1973, when 12-year-old Santos and his 13-year-old brother David were picked up at their home by two Dallas cops. Police suspected them of robbing a vending machine at a nearby gas station. Police handcuffed them and put them in their squad car. They denied being involved. Officer Daryl Kane decided to play Russian roulette, aiming the gun at the back of Santos's head. He pulled the trigger, and nothing. The second time, a bullet struck Santos in the head. Jesse Moreno is now spearheading an effort to create a public art project in Santos's honor at Pike Park.
This is what it's about for me, is to pass that history on, that we don't forget what happened, that we learn from what happened.
Moreno's looking for community input to determine what form the project will take. He says he wants to unite people with whatever it is, a mural, a sculpture, or something else.
Of course, the unanswered question in everybody's mind is why? Why did a Dallas police officer point his pistol at a youngster's head?
Also marking the 45th anniversary of Santos's death is a new documentary about what happened that morning, the aftermath, and the impact on the Mexican-American community. The filmmaker Byron Hunter was a child living in Dallas when Santos was killed. His dad was a civil rights activist.
He, realizing that he had a son that was 9 years old, just a little bit younger than Santos, felt it important to come and tell me what had happened and help me understand the challenges of being a young person of color in Dallas and how it shouldn't be that way and we shouldn't have to do certain things, but how we have to be aware of certain things.
Hunter hopes the documentary accomplishes many things, including telling the story of Santos's mother, Bessie Rodriguez, after her son's death. What Hunter didn't want the film to be about was police brutality. Instead, he wants his film to offer healing and hope, and raise money to help Santos's mother and brother.
I want people to learn about Little Mexico. I want the people to learn about the success of the Mexican community. I want people to learn a lot of things, but I want people to also realize that, like, this woman is still alive, and she's still struggling, and she's living in the projects in West Dallas.
For his part, Jesse Moreno thinks the Pike Park Art Project would also help bring closure to the family, especially Santos's mom.
I think this would mean a lot to her to be able to see this take place. Now, I just want the public to know that the funding is there. It's going to happen. It's more of a timeline now.
Moreno says $75,000 has already been set aside for the project from his park's district funds. And whatever the public art project ends up being, he says it has to be honest.
I've had people who are trying to tone this down and say Santos died. You know, Santos didn't die. Santos was murdered. And we have to be real. We have to be transparent. And we have to accept what happened.
Ultimately, Byron and Moreno say they hope their projects will help people move forward. In Dallas, I'm Stella Chavez.
What happens when you ask 35 Cuban women writers to write stories in the voice of another character. You end up with the 2016 collection, The Oval Portrait, Contemporary Cuban Women Writers and Artists. That's a pretty neutral title for this assemblage of experimental fiction. In each story, the individual authors embody the voice of another woman, real or fictional, sometimes not letting the reader know who she is personifying on the page. It's a project that captured the attention of poet, writer, and translator Margaret Randall. Her translation of The Oval Portrait was published earlier this year by Wings Press. Randall joined us on the phone from her home in Albuquerque, New Mexico.
It's an absolutely fascinating book in which these writers write in the person of Alice in Wonderland, Hannah Arendt, Hypatia of Alexandria, the Japanese woman who was the first woman to summit Mount Everest. And some of them, as I say, were not historic figures, but figures out of the writer's imagination. I brought the book home with me. I read it in the moment. This was a book that I wanted to translate, although it was very, very difficult. I must say I've done a lot of translating from the Spanish over the past, I don't know, decade, and long before as well. And this really did present some extraordinary challenges, but I was finally able to do it to my satisfaction.
You were mentioning that many of the characters that the writers embody, sometimes they're historical figures, or there are other figures who may not be well known. But yet, when you're reading these stories, there's really no illusion as to who these characters are. In the case of Alice, the Alice in Wonderland story that you're talking about, it's pretty evident that's what the story was based upon. But many others, like the one you had mentioned about the first Japanese woman to scale Mount Everest, I believe that story is called Half an Hour on the Summit. It's apparent to the reader that, oh, this is a woman who is achieving the very first moment that no other woman has achieved before, no other Japanese woman. And so how was it that you were able to embody these voices through the voices of these authors? Because you're translating so many different women writers in the voice that they would like to communicate, but in another language. So what were the challenges that you saw when you were trying to tell the stories of these characters through the voices of these Cuban women writers?
It's such an interesting question that you're putting forth, because that was indeed the challenge. And as I say, it was a multi-layered challenge. First, to capture the voice of the writer herself, which is always what you try to do when you translate from one language to another. You want to be able to bring that voice, whether it's a woman's or a man's, the writer's voice, into the language into which you're translating, with the humor, with cultural allusions, with syntax, with rhythm, and so forth. You know, that's one challenge. And of course, in these pieces, there was that additional challenge of then portraying that other voice, the voice that the woman was writing in. Each of these women approached their subject differently. I mean, some, as you noted, immediately in the title or in the subtitle of the piece, sort of announced who that subject was. But others sort of wanted the reader to come upon the information gradually, or perhaps not even until the end of the piece. And so I had to respect that as well. There are also a number of pieces. The very first piece in the book is one of them, that deal with particularly Cuban personages, identities. I mean, the first piece is about a very well-known Cuban transgender entertainer. Anyone in Cuba would have known just from reading the first name of this person who she was. And the same is true of Sarah Gomez, another piece in which the writer is writing in the voice of the first Cuban filmmaker, woman filmmaker, excuse me. But those personages wouldn't necessarily be known outside of Cuba. So, you know, that was sort of an added layer of challenge. So I just had to work on each piece individually, you know, try to figure out what the intention of the writer was in each case, whether she wanted the identity of her protagonist to be known immediately or slowly, and then just follow her lead.
And you alluded also earlier to you having traveled to Cuba. You obviously have a great resilience with the Spanish language, a great knowledge of the Spanish language in order to be able to translate freely. Where did you gain that knowledge of the Spanish language, and how did you go across the path of becoming a translator and making somebody else's words translate into English in an effective manner?
I grew up not knowing any Spanish. But when I was very, very young, I went to Spain. I was 18. I went to Spain with my first husband. We stayed a couple of years. We went broke. We got jobs, etc. And that was where I learned my very first smattering of Spanish. Later, on my own, I went to Mexico City, where I ended up living for 8 years. In the 1960s. And at that point, I married a Mexican poet, Sergio Mondragón, and we founded a bilingual magazine, El Cuerno Emplumado, The Plume Torn. Our goal was to really translate poetry in both languages. And we did that for 8 years and did a lot of translation. That was sort of my first experience with translation back in the 1960s. After that, I moved to Cuba, where I lived for 11 years, and then to Nicaragua, where I lived an additional 4 years. So I did live in Spanish-speaking countries for 23 years, and my four children, all of them, their first language is Spanish, and we speak Spanish among ourselves. So Spanish did become sort of a very fluent second language for me, although I continue to write in English. Of course, as you know, all of the Latin American countries and Spain speak very different Spanishes, so that Mexican Spanish is different from Cuban Spanish, etc. My contact with Cuban Spanish is pretty ongoing, and my contact with Cuban poets and with what's being published. So I've translated quite a bit of Cuban work, especially in the last several years. I think I have this feeling that today, with all this so-called fake news and language being so distorted by our current administration and language really losing its true value and content, I feel that we need to go to literature and poetry in particular to retrieve that content. So I guess I enjoy doing what I consider my little part by doing these translations.
That's poet, writer, and translator Margaret Randall. Her translation of the 2016 book, The Oval Portrait, Contemporary Cuban Women Writers and Artists, was published this year. Coming up, cookbooks created by the housekeeping staff at the University of Texas at San Antonio are being preserved for future research and study.
So it's important to give an opportunity for folks like our housekeepers to express their identities, their stories, their histories, their culinary traditions, and preserve them for the future.
That's next on Fronteras. Stay with us. Welcome back to Fronteras. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio in San Antonio. When we sit down to a plate of enchiladas or fideo, we often don't take note of the history behind what's on that plate. The University of Texas at San Antonio does. The UTSA Library's Special Collections has incorporated a Mexican cookbook collection of over 1,500 books, including one dating back to 1789. A recent addition to that collection shares recipes from one of the invisible but ever-present groups of workers at the university.
This is a rice con green bean, carne picada.
That's Erlinda Castillo. She's turning through some of the pages of a cookbook she created that's been added to this special collection.
Hamburger meat and the side. You put onion.
Castillo is a member of UTSA's operations and maintenance staff. You might know them better as housekeeping. Castillo and a group of other UTSA housekeepers have created a collection of cookbooks known as Rincón de los Antojos, roughly translated as Cravings Corner. The books contain recipes reflective of their culture and upbringing. Castillo's book is brightly decorated with what looks like gift wrap with zoo animals. It has three handwritten recipes inside.
Enchiladas, rice with chicken, fideo, with carne picada. Very delicious.
These are recipes she learned from her mother. Sofia Nieto is another member of the UTSA operations and maintenance staff. Her book is smaller in nature and cut into the shape of a bay leaf, a key ingredient in one of her recipes.
So, and this is the ingredient they give you most of the flavor. So that's why I'm looking for something like show my recipe.
Nieto's recipes have also been handed down over the generations. The idea for creating this unique collection of cookbooks grew out of what, on the surface, is an entirely unrelated experience Erlinda Castillo encountered at a staff meeting in 2012. The housekeeping staff was told they'd have to clock in using computers. That announcement was met with fear and trepidation.
People, they were so scared, you know, because we didn't know nothing but computer. We don't know nothing about what button to push or whatever.
While making her rounds across campus, Castillo happened upon Ilna Colmier, Instruction Technology Coordinator with UTSA's College of Education and Human Development. Castillo asked Colmier if she would teach her about computers. Castillo picks up where the conversation continued the following day.
Herlinda, yes, ma'am. Do you have a moment? I said, yes, ma'am. Come to the conference room. We need to talk to you. Okay. And say, have a seat. Okay. Your wish come true. And I say, my wish come true. And he say, yes, Linda's wish is yes, you're going to learn computer. Oh, thank God. I'm going to learn computer now. All the housekeeping going to learn computer now. And then when she told me that, my tears just came out of my eyes.
That computer training program came to be known as Erlinda's Wish. Since its inception, over 100 housekeepers on campus have been keeping up with their computer and English speaking skills. Those skills went into the creation and design of this unique collection of cookbooks. Ilna Colmier is the instructor approached by Erlinda Castillo in 2012.
I think this is the first program of its kind, and again, it all began with one question from one voice, Erlinda's.
Agnieszka Chabłakow is the rare books librarian at the UTSA Library's Special Collection. She says the Erlinda's Wish cookbooks represent voices that are traditionally not included in archival or special collections.
They kind of alert us to the fact that the stories that these communities have are valuable and they matter and they should be preserved and they should be collected. So it's important to give an opportunity for folks like our housekeepers to express their identities, their stories, their histories, their culinary traditions, and preserve them for the future.
Ilna Colmier, the instructor who began teaching computer skills to the housekeeping staff, says the Erlinda's Wish program has given them a voice. But
I hate to keep calling them housekeepers. That is not their identity. They're philosophers, they're artists, they're poets. We have a poet among them. They're problem solvers, innovators, critical thinkers. They're collaborators. They are amazingly talented. Housekeeper is not their identity.
That fear and trepidation Erlinda Castillo felt when told she was going to have to learn how to clock in using a computer, it's a thing of the past.
No, I feel so happy. I know what button to push, and now I know I can put my name on it and look something else. Oh, you want to look like the flowers, just put roses, whatever. Now we know to do that.
And Sofia Nieto takes satisfaction in knowing her cookbook creation will be available for research and study for generations of UTSA students.
I know my grandsons and my great-great-grandsons can come to UTSA and have part of me here at UTSA because they can find my book here at UTSA. Not everybody have it. So I'm so excited and I'm so happy.
Thanks for joining us this week on Fronteras. You can find the show under the Programs tab on our website, tpr.org, and wherever you get your podcasts. Norma Martinez produced the broadcast. Our executive producers are Steve Short and Fernando Ortiz. Our digital editor is Vince Kong. Charanga Cakewalk composed our theme music. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio in San Antonio.